elections, where everybody else has all the national elections and most other people's elections are on the even years. So that's how we always get the year after a presidential election, you get something going on. There's an election in Virginia that goes on, and it's often viewed as a little bit of a, often overinterpreted, but sometimes properly interpreted, as a bellwether for what's going on in national politics and for the direction things are going and for, you know, are people sufficiently upset with the party that's in power? Are they happy with the party that's in power, et cetera? Now, I thought that this year the Virginia election was becoming kind of a sleepy affair, not that much drama. It didn't look like the Republican was doing all that well. And then in the last couple of weeks, it got interesting. So I was going to, when we first planned this, I was going to make some sort of general observations about elections and that sort of thing. But now it looks like what I really want to do is say something much more specific about what's happened here in Virginia. One of the things that happened is that the Virginia election unexpectedly became a referendum not on Donald Trump, not on on Joe Biden, but it became a referendum on public education, which I think is very interesting. And so what happened is that it really started when Terry McAuliffe, who was the former governor, Democratic governor, who's running for re-election or running for election a second time, made a gaffe. And a gaffe is usually, you know, the usual definition of a gaffe in politics is when a politician accidentally says the truth. And what happened here is that he said that he didn't think that parents should have a direct say in their kids' education. Now, I think what he meant by it in the context was he says an individual parent by protesting shouldn't have the ability to change the entire school curriculum, but it sort of came to be symbolically taken as this declaration that the schools are run for the benefit of the administrators and for the benefit of the teachers and the teachers' unions and not for the benefit of the kids and for the benefit of their parents. And that hit a big nerve in Virginia, partly because of the post-COVID thing, that the Virginia public schools were closed for like a year and the kids were, you know, at home living Lord of the Flies, trying to do school on Zoom, which really doesn't work, and especially for the younger kids, really doesn't work. They were doing that for a year because partly because the administrators and the teachers' unions dug in their heels and basically said, we're not going to reopen live school. We're going to wait on that. We're going to push it off as far as possible because we're basically getting paid to stay home and not do very much. And so that, of course, is the ultimate ideal of every union, is that it achieves for its membership the privilege of being able to not really work very much and get paid well and have good benefits. So that is sort of the context for it, that there's this spirit of rebellion or of dissatisfaction with the public schools that the Republican candidate managed to tap into. And the Democratic candidate, Terry McAuliffe, you know, this is a guy who he came to be governor of Virginia the first time because he was a lifelong hanger-on of the Democratic Party, a political fixer. He wasn't a politician in his own right. He was a political fixer and a hanger-on of the Clinton machine. And this was basically his reward for a lifetime of loyalty. Was that they would put him up for governor of Virginia. And at the time, he had a weak opponent. The Republicans were very weak electorally. And so he managed to get in. But he's a terrible politician. He is not good at this at all. And he has basically just, you know, he got into a hole and he kept digging on this. And for example, just last night, he brought in on his side, he brought in Randy Weingarten, the head of one of the big teachers unions, to speak at one of his rallies. So he's like doubling down on the idea that, yes, I represent the teachers' unions over and against the parents in the schools. So I'm viewing this from a bit of a distance because I was never foolish enough to send my kids to the Virginia public schools because I knew all these problems were out there. And I've, you know, worked hard and scrambled at times to be able to keep my kids in a good private school. But for those who do have their kids in the public schools, this has become sort of a rallying cry of rebellion against the public school system. And that's why this thing is so close and is looking right now like a probable win for the Republican, but but I'm not sure. Now, there are other issues involved in this election, and there are certain reasons for me to be dissatisfied with the Republican candidate. But I think that's what the interesting thing about the Virginia election is: it unexpectedly became a sort of proxy vote for people to express their dissatisfaction with the public schools. Now, they're still not in Virginia, in case we get too excited about this, they're still not in Virginia at the point where they're dissatisfied enough with the public schools to actually have school choice. So I'd be a whole lot more excited about this election if there were a realistic chance that the Virginia General Assembly and the Senate were going to vote for a some kind of school choice measure for those of us, you know, to allow kids to escape the public schools entirely. This is more of the typical sort of conservative cycle where people get upset with how the welfare state's being administered, and so they vote in somebody new to administer it better without really questioning the structure of the modern welfare state. And I actually do think that public schools belong in the category of the welfare state. So people still aren't going quite to the depth of challenging the whole system and rearranging the way the whole system is done. But it's their statement of rebellion against the idea that they feel like the schools are not being run for the benefit of themselves, of the parents and the children. They feel like it's being run for the benefit of the bureaucrats and the teachers' unions. So that makes it an unexpectedly exciting election day in Virginia.
What do you find objectionable in the Republican candidate?
Not much personally. I really think that he's basically, people have said in the general election, he has run like Mitt Romney. That is, he's run as a sort of milquetoasty, and he's very much, he actually has the personal biography of Mitt Romney in a way, in that he is one of these private equity investment guys, made a lot of money, and then decided to go into politics. And he's a really sort of milquetoasty, moderate kind of guy, very, very much of a moderate Republican who you would expect to do well in Northern Virginia, where, you know, rural Virginia, people are much more conservative, but in Northern Virginia, they're more moderate. The only objection, real objection I have to him is that he sort of, in the Democratic primaries, the standard held up, and this has become across the Republican Party, was that you had to affirm that the 2020 election was stolen. You had to hedge around not saying that Joe Biden actually won the 2020 election. And you had to sort of, you know, play footsie at least with the crowd that sort of has these election conspiracy theories. And my concern about that is whoever gets elected to governor right now in Virginia, he's going to be governor in 2024. And if there's some big fight brought up about the election and the results of the election in 2024, as you know was attempted with the last election, I would like a guy who I could trust to stand up and, you know, have the integrity to say, look, here's the results, here's what I think the results are, and I'm going to stand by them. Glenn Youngkin, who's the Republican candidate here in Virginia, basically said, if it ticks off the base of the party, I'm not going to do it. He was not exactly a profile in courage on this. So he's a guy I'm not going to be confident is going to stand up and do the right thing, whatever that is, in 2024. Plus, there are some other there's some other concerns that we'll get to, I think, as the discussion continues. Yeah.
Scott, David, you guys. David in particular is a little closer to it, being in D.C. But Scott, did you have some thoughts?
I'm just curious, because you can use that to say, because any Republican's not going to want to upset their own base.
Yeah.
And so, they're just not going to want to talk about it that much. And it can become an excuse just to not want any Republican to win. And I mean, just in terms of McAuliffe, I mean, he's the Clinton's bag man. I mean, I remember him, before they left office, he was, getting them a mortgage in 2000. So it just, I just don't see him as a paragon of virtue.
He is absolutely not a paragon of virtue. This is one of those cases where I have no motivation at all to support McAuliffe. But I want to say the importance of the election issue. I think that's people are going to want to dismiss it and say, oh, well, they're just, you know, nobody's going to want to upset the base. Well, the problem with that is precisely what has happened to the base. Because if you have one party that is deeply committed, and they have become deep, the Republicans have become deeply committed to the idea that they will not accept the result of any election they don't win, then you have a major, major catastrophic problem with the way the political system is working. I am actually setting up a litmus test. Now, personally, I'm setting up a litmus test for Republican candidates that you have to stick your neck out at least a little bit to say that you disagree with that. Because I do think there's a chance, a significant chance, that it could come down to the wire 3 years from now on Election Day. That you'll have, I mean, we have a lot of evidence now that Trump had a plan to basically throw out the results of the election last year, to throw out the results of the election and declare himself the winner by throwing out the certified results. That was what January 6th was all about. He tried to pressure Mike Pence into it. And we have lots of evidence now with memos, you know, the Eastman memo, things like that, that they prepared for this. So if that sort of thing is attempted again, I really want to have as my litmus test for a Republican that I can rely on you to stick your neck out and say no to that. And so I think the very simplest standard I have for a political party is I want to vote for the people who want to let me vote again, right? You know, I don't want the people who want one man, one vote, one time, which is the old
Democrats lose, they just accuse the candidate of being a Russian spy or, you know,
Are terrible on this. And McAuliffe in particular was terrible on this because he's the guy who, you know, he never affirmed up to today. He still won't affirm that George W. Bush lost George W. Bush won the 2000 election. He still claims Al Gore won and that it was stolen from Gore. So that's one of the reasons why McAuliffe was never able to use this as an issue in this election, because he's just as bad, if not worse. But the point is that just because one party's bad doesn't mean, you know, doesn't let the Republicans off the hook.
But one of the two is going to win.
Because I think the Republicans are the ones who are likely to cause trouble in this issue 3 years from now. So that's what I've got in my mind. And I think, you know, it's a consideration you have to take. You can't stick your head in sand about it.
Well, I probably would fail your litmus test, Rob, because, you know, I have a full-time job plus, but I have tried to study and follow the details and watched most of the public, you know, hearings of people that had witnessed or claimed to have witnessed irregularities. And I can't figure it out. So I guess I think you have to maybe make a distinction between people who strongly suspect that there was actually a tampering of the vote and shenanigans going on, and those who say, well, no matter what the election results are, I'm not going to accept them. So.
Well, but here's the thing. You have to look at what was the Republican approach to trying to find – well, first of all, every time they went into court with a case to try to say here's what we think is wrong with the election, they never came up with a claim that would actually stand up in court. They had a lot of innuendo and stuff like that that basically just when it met evidentiary standards of a court of law, it fell apart. But the other thing is, though, that the actual attempt that Donald Trump made, in January with the riot at the Capitol, and we now have a lot of information about this, is that he had a memo drafted basically that said, legally, constitutionally, the vice president can simply declare the election results invalid, and that there's no constitutional authority for that whatsoever. So I think if you have complaints about the election, you have to have a way of redressing that complaint that stays within the Constitution and was actually a constitutional response to it. And to the extent that they've actually done that, they've not been able to make the case stick. Now, what they did instead is they came up with an even more flagrantly unconstitutional answer to that. And that's what I want, is I want somebody, you know, so if Glenn Youngkin wants to go out, and as he did, and talk about how we need to make sure there's election integrity and I have these reforms I want to do, I'm fine, and then I want to listen to that. But I also want somebody who's going to come out and say, you know, the conspiracy theories and the unproven claims and the extra constitutional attempts to get to throw out the election result, that he's against all of that. I mean, it's a pretty low bar to have for a politician, right?
You still have to compare them to Democrats.
I have to compare them to office. Democrats, but I don't think the sins of the Democrats. Here's where I disagree with a lot of people, and I think especially I found myself disagreeing with a lot of objectivists about this, which is the sins of the Democrats do not give the Republicans a pass for basically anything. And that's, the people say, oh, the Democrats are terrible. Well, I know the Democrats are terrible. They've been terrible forever, right? That's not news to me. But I think we have to get, I think what happened is a lot of people got used to the idea of we have allies on the right, that the people on the right, that the Republicans are our political allies. And they've gotten too comfortable with that and have not been willing to readjust that expectation. And I think we have to get back to what used to be sort of, you know, I think anybody who's more on the libertarian side of things, you know, what surprises me, I think we should all be used to the idea of neither one of these people is on our side. Neither the left nor the right is on our side. They would all sell out our freedom in one way or another if given the chance. So just because one side is terrible doesn't mean that we have to ally ourselves with the other side. We have to hold them both to a certain standard. And I think that the Republicans, especially in the Trump era and with the sort of religious nationalist, the collectivist nationalist ideology that's now becoming much more prominent on the right, they're really putting us to the test on that. They're really reminding us that just because the Democrats are bad doesn't mean these guys are good. And I really want to sort of drum that in, because I grew up with that. I grew up with the era where you had to really remember. I mean, I remember Nixon, right? Just about every bad thing in American politics you can think of, it started with Nixon. The EPA, the affirmative action, ending the gold standard, all these terrible things in our American political system, they all began with Nixon. He was one of the worst presidents we've ever had. He was a Republican. So the idea that the Republicans are not our friends, you know, I think we've all been spoiled by, we were spoiled by years of Reaganism, where Reagan had, you know, in his rhetoric at least, and to some extent in his policies, he was much friendlier to people, to our point of view. But I think we have to adjust to the fact that you can't take that for granted anymore with Republicans.
So I wanted to let everybody know we are going to record the session so that our objective is to make these available on our podcast platform, because we're still dragging, inviting, getting people to join the platform, but we have a few holdouts who haven't joined. I'd also love to talk a little bit about this hoax that was perpetrated by the Democratic operatives to try to smear Youngkin by pretending that there was a group of tiki torch carrying white nationalists.
They had a couple of guys sort of cosplaying the neo-Nazis who were here in Charlottesville in 2017.
Yeah, so we'll get to that, but I see David unmuted himself, so I'd love to get his thoughts on the discussion.
Yeah, I've been aware of the election, but not following it anywhere near as closely as Rob, and mainly focused on the school board issues and parents.
Yeah.
Because that's a potentially, you know, nationwide issue. I mean, everything else is, in a sense. But I have a question, Rob. Why does Trump still have the hold that he does? I mean, you know, there have been disputed elections before. You mentioned Bush v. Gore. And you know, Al Gore grumbled about it for a while, and then he went on. Hillary grumbled about losing in 2016, and she was, you know, her usual nasty self about it. But, you know, things moved on. Trump is still, you know, apparently, you know, trying to, you know, get back for what he still, for what he seems to believe is was a stolen election. And, you know, I can understand that. I never liked Trump. I know you didn't either. And I'm glad he's gone. Not that I like his replacement. But my question is, why does he still have such a hold? Is he still the leader of the, what you call the nationalist religious wing of objectivism? I mean, of objectivism, yeah. Of the, that got him elected in 2016. Why, I mean, Youngkin seems like a pretty straightforward guy. Why does he feel any pressure to, you know, sidestep or walk on eggs around the issue of Trump?
Okay, so I think part of it is that, oddly, political parties do tend to get pushed around by personalities, right? So I remember, so years during the Tea Party movement, see, I, part of the reason I'm grumpy about the current state of the Republican Party is I was pretty involved with the local Tea Party group in Charlottesville. And that was a point at which the Republican Party was moving very much in the direction I liked. That, you know, they were trying to appease the base they were trying to appease were the Tea Party people who were the radical small government types. And of course, they never delivered all that much for the Tea Party, but they at least, you know, they tried to deliver it in rhetoric and that sort of thing. And, you know, a few spending cuts here and there and that sort of thing. And then, of course, they've gone very much the opposite direction. And I think part of what happened, I noticed, though, is that the Tea Party movement was also sort of a personal sort of land of opportunity for me. I got lots of interesting opportunities to do things, including I moderated a number of debates in the Republican Party primaries for two different congressional districts, so the 5th District and the 2nd District. And so the one thing I noticed is when you went to these political primaries, there was one in the 2nd District, Virginia Beach. It was funny, we had like two or three different guys who were running who were ex-Navy SEALs. That gives you an idea of what that district is like. But they had a huge number of candidates there. But the thing is, you would go there and ask them, you know, when you'd ask them who was their influence, you basically, the answer you got back every single time was Ronald Reagan. That was the safe answer that everybody gave that they knew would be pleasing to the audience, right? So that gives you an idea of the sort of now this was 10, 12 years ago. This gives you an idea of the lingering impact that a single personality can have on a political party. So partly it's sort of the cult of personality thing, but I think there's another reason behind it, which is that I call this one Dr. Reagan and Mr. Trump, sort of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that there's a Jekyll and Hyde aspect to the Republican Party and has been for a long time, that ideologically and philosophically, they've got two elements. They have the sort of classical liberal element, the element that says we're for freedom, we're for free markets, we're for this optimistic view of American greatness based on freedom. And then there's the less, the darker side of conservatism, which is we are for going back to the past. We're for tradition. We're for national greatness and the subjugation of the individual to the greatness of the nation. And we're for religious traditionalism. And we think that everything was better. And there's this sort of what we call temperamental conservatism of everything was better when I was a kid, right? So if you listen to Trump, he's very consistent on this. It's like everything circa 1973 was basically so much better than it is today, or everything, you know, everything the way it was when he was young was definitely the way better than anything that's happening today, and we should try to go back to the past. And so there's two elements of conservatism. The sort of optimist, classical, liberal, individualist aspect of the right, and then the more European-style, nationalist, conservative aspect to the right that's distrustful of foreigners, etc. And I think what happened is Trump unleashed the id of that nationalist, traditionalist, pessimistic version of conservatism, and did it. He pandered to them in a way that nobody had pandered to them for 50 years, and really since before Goldwater, nobody had pandered to them like that. And so I think he tapped in so deeply to that aspect of conservatism that they developed a love and devotion to him that's even stronger than the Republican Party used to have for Reagan. So I think it's sort of that element of battling for the soul of the Republican Party that caused this attraction that he has to them. Now that, and I think that they're also being, you know, he tapped into, and this connects to this current race in Virginia, and this is the positive aspect, is that it's also the case that a huge amount of the public is ready for a rebellion against political correctness. Now, I do not like the form of rebellion that Trump gives them, which is basically, I'm going to embody all the caricatures and stereotypes of the, you know, of basically, I'm going to be Archie Bunker to your meathead, for those who remember that television show. The sort of Archie Bunker conservatism as a rebellion against political correctness. I don't like his form of rebellion. But in this race in particular with Youngkin, it shows that people are really fed up and ready to strike back against the attempt to bring political correctness into the schools and bring critical race theory and all the current poisonous racial politics that we have, to bring that into the kids' schools. That's part of this rebellion, and that's one of the things that people are really fed up with. So that's the positive aspect, is there is this hunger for rebellion against that. The problem is that the Republicans aren't always offering a really healthy form of that rebellion.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree that to the extent it wasn't just Trump as a candidate and his particular policies, and to me those were, it was less about nostalgia, and specifically he was very consistent in talking about concern with regard to border security and illegal immigration. Agree or disagree with him, but that was always a mainstay of his platform. And then also concerns about China. So, you know, the other issues, to me at least, seem a little bit more stylistic. So we are getting some raised hands in the audience. I'm going to bring Damien up to ask a question or make a comment, and I want to encourage the rest of you to jump in as well.
Hello?
Yeah. Hey, Damien.
Hello.
Question?
I just kind of wanted to give a comment. Coming from my perspective on my community and, you know, people that I know. And I just wanted to say that for me, I think I would say that the Trump era kind of got me more engaged in politics to even pay attention. So I would credit him with that. Once I started to learn more about it, I would probably say I disagree with a lot of things that, you know, he may have proposed, but I still give him, I guess, the credit for kind of waking people like myself or people that are around me up to even pay more attention to what's going on. And then I would also say that I appreciate that thing there, but the other thing is that he fights back. So I know a lot of times I hear people, you know, they have different perspectives or different views. And I think a lot of people maybe that I would know respect the fact that somebody fights back, because that's important to me. It's very interesting to see a lot
Absolutely.
Of people have theories and they have their, you know, political stances and they want to talk. I mean, and it's a lot of intellectual things. And I think that they're all important. But at the end of the day, if there's no consequence for people, I don't know, taking advantage of you, or if people using or manipulating situations, if there's no consequence behind that, it's like no bite to the bark. So I guess that's my perspective right there.
All right. So one of the reasons I want to say that this is what makes people like me grind my teeth to no end. And I'm not blaming you, because you don't quite realize, you might not realize the context for this, but there are those of us who have been going hammer and tongs on these issues for decades. And then somebody comes and says, oh, finally someone who fights. Well, you know, I was fighting. There are lots of us who were fighting. He's the guy who fights in a way that resonates with you, that makes you notice it, okay? But it doesn't mean nobody was fighting. So one of the things, for example, I want to go on this is the only time in the last 20 years that I have seen somebody actually decrease year to year decrease in federal spending. Do you know who did it? Anybody know who did it?
Yeah, it's Clinton.
No. That's not in the last 20 years. He hasn't been in office for 20 years. It's been 20 years since he was out of office. It was John Boehner. It was the Republican establishment guys in 2012, 2013. They had something called the sequester. Now, most people won't even remember this because it was an inside Washington politics thing. John Boehner was not maybe the most engaging personality. But he's the guy who actually managed to outmaneuver the other guys politically, including I think he was negotiating with Joe Biden was like the guy heading up the White House's negotiations for this. And people sort of chuckle about that to this day because Joe Biden is infamous as a terrible negotiator. So they put Joe Biden out there and John Boehner ate his lunch. And partly by accident, because Boehner actually got more than he was trying to get. But the other side was such terrible negotiators. He actually got something called the sequester, which led to a year after year decrease in government spending, briefly, temporarily, for a couple of years. And it was an amazing thing. And this is a response to pressure from the Tea Party coming to John Boehner from below. All right, but this gives me an idea that one thing I want to make is that who you think is fighting in politics is not always the people who are actually fighting. So the guy who makes a lot of noise. Exactly. And I think Trump is the guy who makes a lot of noise. And I think he resonates with a lot of people, especially if you're – see, I'm a Midwesterner. Trump never resonated with me because I'm a Midwesterner. We're too polite. We're too nice. A guy like Trump seems just like a maniac to us. But if you're a New Yorker, right? And a fellow I used to write in The Federalist said, Donald Trump is an outer borough New York guy, right? And that all of the exaggeration and the over-the-top rhetoric and all that, that's just normal to those people, to somebody from that background. So if you're more of an East Coast type, I can see that definitely he would resonate with you as this is the loudmouth who's going to come in and bust heads and he's going to say nasty things about the other guys and he's really fighting. But if you look at what he actually accomplished in office, now the only thing he accomplished from my perspective that I really, really liked was that he actually decreased temporarily, but very significantly, but temporarily decreased the amount of regulation coming out of the federal government. He actually put these policies in place that vastly decreased the number of new regulations coming out. And it was great. And all the other stuff he did with the culture war stuff was, in a way, was good because it distracted everybody. And they paid attention to that, and nobody paid attention to what he was doing with the regulatory stuff. But other than that, there's very little that he actually accomplished in terms of a permanent thing that he put into place. Like, he didn't build the wall that he was going to build on the southern border, assuming that would have worked, which I'm skeptical about. He didn't, a lot of the stuff he did by executive order then got undone the next day by executive order. The spending and taxes went down in some ways, but the spending. Spending went up. It went way up under Trump. Every year it went. The problems we have in politics, though, is that.
Can I add one piece? I don't know if you were finishing that.
Yeah, go ahead. And Chris, if you could put yourself on mute for a second, we'll get to you. Thanks.
Okay. I understand that. But I guess for me, I look at it as like in two pieces. Yes, there's substance and there's like a marketing aspect. And to me, you kind of have to have investments on both sides, in my opinion. And you can't forget about either side. I'm not saying that nobody ever fought before. But what I'm saying is that, like, you were correct in saying that, yes, that resonated with me and people like myself, the way that he fought back, because I think that that is a way that people like myself would recognize that. And so, and like I said at the beginning, I don't necessarily agree with the policies, because as I learned more about politics as I went along, I understood, okay, some of these things I don't like and I don't agree with. But I think that there is something to be said with the style in getting to the people. So I just think that that is something that people kind of like poo-poo or whatever, his approach. But there's something to be learned by how he connected with people. That's what I'll say.
Yeah, Damien, I have to agree with you there. You can have, you know, the most brilliant policies or the most brilliant speeches or whatever, but if you're not getting through, and if you're not bold, and I mean, I think a large part of that was his willingness to cry, you know, the fake news and to push back against against the media's distortions and outright lies. Chris, did you want to jump in now?
Yeah, sure. Hey, first of all, Jag, I want to commend all of you for all this work you're doing in Spanish. It's great. But now getting onto the topic, you know, I was born and raised in a state that Jimmy Carter won in 1980. I never dreamed it would go red. That's West Virginia. And, you know, you look at the base that the blue team used to have. They were the party of, you know, these steel workers and coal miners, and those people left because they felt neglected. And Trump basically said, it's okay for you to be angry. You know, not to mention, I think we also have to bring up this another issue too. And the fact that, you know, the only issue that has mattered to the conservatives in the red team really since the end of World War II has been spending money on the military and invading the world. And that, of course, includes a man named Bill Kristol, who's another big promoter of that. And a lot of these, I think these people that would be called the alt-right or the new right are fed up with that. They just said, let's take care of our own and, you know, rebuild our own infrastructure because it's falling apart. You know, I mean, in the case of West Virginia, it's the only state that's lost population since 1940.
All right, so I mean, I popped off a little bit earlier, so I missed some of what one of the previous fellows said. But well, let's talk about West Virginia. Okay, so West Virginia's lost.
Chris, if you can mute.
What's that?
Thanks. No, just getting the line clear. Thanks. Go ahead.
Oh, I didn't know if I was coming in or not. So I would say Trump says it's okay to be angry. But the problem is that anger itself, anger per se, is not a solution, right? And I sort of think that part of what Republican Party is dealing with right now is what I call the curse of the Reagan Democrats. And that is that the Reagan was the first Republican really to start bringing in the sort of the blue-collar vote. And it was sort of a one-off with Reagan because they liked him. But it has become, you know, it's one of the big things, is that the blue-collar vote has flipped from being pro-Democrat to being pro-Republican, because the Democrats have become, over time, progressively, they've become the party of the educated upper middle class, right? They become the party of the universities. And that's been accelerating since the 1960s and has become very much the case today. If you're the urban, educated, upper middle class, it really runs the Democratic Party. And I think that's, you know, the race in Virginia right now is a great example of that, because basically McAuliffe's only hope is going out and rallying the vote as much as he can in the middle class suburbs of Northern Virginia, and he can't go campaign anywhere else and get rely on much of a response because that's who his base is now, and that I think that's why also people are panicking that. They expected Donald Trump wouldn't get any votes from black voters. He wouldn't get any votes from Hispanic voters. And he got more than Romney did. And part of the reason for that is because he is appealing to the blue-collar outlook and the blue-collar attitude and is able to appeal to the blue-collar voters, while the Democratic Party seems to be on a crusade to repel those voters as much as possible. One of my favorite examples is Latinx. If you heard that, you know, you've probably heard about this, that this is somebody cooked this up as this sort of politically correct way of referring to people of Hispanic origin. They refer to them as Latinx with an X on the end, which makes no sense whatsoever in the Spanish language. And you know, they do polls and find like 94% of actual Hispanic people don't use it, don't think it makes any sense, don't want to use it. But the Democratic Party is in thrall to people who insist on using this thing that, you know, that puts them basically shows that just demonstrates how out of touch they are with the average Hispanic voter. So that's the sort of problem that the Democrats have. But the problem is, again, because the Democrats are terrible doesn't mean that the answer being offered on the other side is good. And Donald Trump appealed to told people it's okay to be angry, but he appealed to anger and to this unfocused anger, and oftentimes without a good idea of what's the proper response. And so, for example, you mentioned, you know, one of his issues was border security. Well, but the thing that really launched him was one of the first campaign events where he basically said, people coming from Mexico are a bunch of rapists. I mean, it was really very, it wasn't, you know, we want border security. It wasn't a reason that's the reasonable policy you project onto it. What he actually campaigned on was fear and hatred of immigrants. So to some extent, appealing to anger is not the best thing. As long as, you know, politicians always have to have a mixture of the ability to appeal to the common man, as Reagan did, versus also the ability to then translate that into some kind of reasonable mixture of policy and legislation, which was Reagan was more or less capable of doing. I'm not in the sort of St. Ronald's Reagan camp, but he was a relatively good politician, of the only halfway decent politician of the last 50 years. But Donald Trump, his problem is he appeals primarily just to sort of raw, unfocused anger that doesn't necessarily lead to a reasonable, rational policy agenda.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't take that statement the same way that you did. I don't think that he was being anti-immigrant. He's married to an immigrant. you know, he was just making the point that
he's pro-European immigrants.
I think what he's saying is that he's pro-immigrants that are not going to become wards of the state, are not going to become a burden on taxpayer. And yeah, what about the idea of prioritizing those who have something to offer America in terms of their education, their not having a criminal background, that kind of thing. No,
but the thing is that you're thinking of this on a level that's more sophisticated than Trump thinks about it and more sophisticated than he talks about it. Because his view was, you got all these criminals coming out of the southern border and that's why crime's out of control. That's the way he deals with it. And that's very Archie Bunkerish. You have to... Now, those who didn't grow up with All in the Family and Archie Bunker on their TVs may have to do some research on this. But
how do you know that, though? But could that be a strategy?
Because I watched what he says.
Could that be a strategy? I guess that's my question.
Well, you know, okay, so we've been those of us in the chattering classes who cover politics have been around and around and around on the what they call three-dimensional chess argument with Trump. That, oh, well, that's just a front he puts up. It's just a show he does for the voters. It's part of his strategy behind that. There's this very clever strategy. And the thing is, that's another case of, I think that one of the things that happened in the Trump era is, and by the way, we've gotten very far away from the Virginia election, but one of the things that happens in the Trump era is you have the thoughtful intellectual types who come in and try to reinterpret what Trump means from their own perspective, which is much more sophisticated. And, oh, well, what Trump really means is he wants this very sophisticated policy that I've thought through. But they're reading it into Trump's statements. And I think also the idea that this is strategic, I don't think it's – I've never seen any evidence that there's a strategy behind it. Because if it were strategic, I think there would have been more results. Now, I think what you're getting with somebody like Youngkin and maybe with somebody like Ron DeSantis in Florida, those guys, I see evidence of strategy and calculation, right? That they say, especially DeSantis seems to have this approach of, you know, basically campaign like Trump and then govern more like Jeb Bush, you know, govern like a more reasonable person behind the scenes. There's a lot of evidence of calculation there. But with Trump, I think what you see is what you get, that that's just who he is. That's the guy he is.
Could you back DeSantis?
Well, the problem is, see, I don't like the there are aspects of the agenda that he's standing for that I really don't like. So I think he, as a person, and also I also don't like the idea of the Trumpian rhetoric up front to mask something behind it. I would prefer somebody who is what he says he is, and who I can trust to be that way, who is not calculating, you know what I mean? So I'm not going to endorse DeSantis, but what I'm saying is Trump is not DeSantis. DeSantis is what the sort of the reasonable Trump version that people are trying to come up with. He sounds like Trump in public, but there's more calculation behind it behind the scenes. But I think where people are reading that into Trump, there's a really great temptation for the intellectual classes to read into Trump their preferences for what they would like him to be. And I think it also, you know, among the people who are in the right-wing media sphere, where being pro-Trump sort of, what is it, not being pro-Trump will get you fired. I know that. I found out. I've tested that one. Not being pro-Trump can get you fired from your job. There's a lot of incentive for people in the conservative media to say, well, therefore I have to come up with a respectable way to be pro-Trump. And one way to do that is to say, well, let's take my preferred agenda and let's read that into the latest, into the tea leaves of the latest thing Trump said, and show how maybe he's sort of kind of through three-dimensional chess trying to get to what I would like. And after a while, it just doesn't hold up. It does, you know, that those theories did not work out in terms of the actual results.
Yeah, I like DeSantis, but to me, his drawback is he really is a politician, and Trump was the anti-politician. And DeSantis, I think, is not just intrinsically an anti-tax guy. He has to be reminded of it. So that's not, you know, who he is at his core. And I think maybe some of the other governors might be better. But to Damien's point, you know, about the importance of messaging, of, you know, either having the authenticity, which I think Trump did, or projecting it, which I think DeSantis is attempting, is at least being realistic in recognizing the essential task of connecting with voters. Kirk, you've been patient. Kirk, did you have, maybe you'll bring us back to Virginia.
Yeah, hi. this is maybe not going to bring things back. Sorry about this. But I just wanted to question, with respect to this sort of but he fights argument regarding Trumpism, I question why we should consider it valuable for someone like Trump to fight when that person either stands for policies and ideas that are awful, like Trump tends to do, or stands for absolutely no ideas and is just going to do with whatever he thinks is going to get him elected, get him the most votes, which I think also, to a certain extent,
because everyone else is hiding from the left on the sidelines.
Well, here, okay, so again, I'm going to be grinding my teeth again. You can probably hear it already. And that is, everyone else is not standing on the sidelines doing nothing. That is a talking point invented by the people who are pro-Trump to say not only that he fights, but he's the only one who fights. There have been lots of other people working these issues and actually accomplishing things in these issues. And what you're doing is you're basically saying none of us exist. And that's why I'm grinding my teeth.
Part of it's taking the slings and arrows from the left.
I've taken slings and arrows. I know lots of people who've taken slings and arrows. Okay, there were among the 17 people who were running against Trump, there were people who'd taken slings and arrows, okay? So that's not a differentiating factor. So here's where my cynicism on politicians, okay? Place not thy faith in princes. I think that's from the Bible somewhere. Put not thy faith in princes. Okay, do not trust politicians. Do not trust anyone who says, only I can fix it. Only I will be the one to fight. Because it's probably not true. In fact, it's almost definitely not true. And the people who tell you that are telling you that because they have an interest in scaring you into thinking that you have to vote for them and there's no other alternative. There's almost always another alternative. Okay? So there were lots of other people who had perfectly good agendas who would have been who would have done much this many of the same things you would have liked they would have done in office. Now, here's where I think the real downside of Trumpism comes. Now, we talked about this stunt pulled by of guys cosplaying as neo-Nazis at a Charlottesville campaign rally. Now, by the way, it wasn't Democratic operatives who did that. It was former Republican operatives. This is the Lincoln Project guys, and they're a bunch of former Republican operatives who flipped from fleecing Republican donors to fleecing Democratic Party donors to engage in really badly designed, ineffectual political stunts against Republicans. So it's this very complicated, like layers and layers of grifting that's going on here. So this is a bunch of former Republicans who decided to grift off of Democrats in the Trump era.
Well, no, so it's this... just Rob. I mean, you know, they either took credit for it or, you know, fell on the sword for it. Other people have looked at the people who were standing, at least the actors, maybe, you know, somebody else paid for it and fleeced, you know, Democratic donors for it. But the people who were there, you know, in their little cosplay costumes holding tiki torches have been identified as people who were either with the Youngkin campaign or certainly not necessarily Republicans.
Not the Youngkin campaign, but you mean the
McCollum campaign. Yes.
I haven't followed up on this in a day or so. So the last I saw, it looked like the Lincoln Project people were copping to it. I mean, it looks like the sort of thing they do because it's clueless and they're pretty clueless people.
But the attempt was to make him look like a racist, which is the main thing that I think makes Democrats the greater threat.
Well, no, here, let me, so I, that's why I was going to go towards that, because here's the thing, that the reason they were doing that, now, the reason it fell flat is because it doesn't apply to Youngkin. It's just not convincing applied to Youngkin. It was because it was so transparently a political stunt, right? It did not look genuine, and so it fell flat. And it backfired against the people who attempted it. But the reason they were going for that is because this is the problem with the Trumpian but he fights thing. Because sometimes he picks the wrong fights. And in Charlottesville in 2017, when he did that, there were very fine people on both sides thing. That was a major disaster. That was basically Trump refusing to, or even tacitly embracing, white nationalists.
He wasn't because there weren't doing
very
that.
Fine people on this. And I wrote the definitive article on this. I've written many articles I thought were definitive, but this is the only one that's been widely recognized as definitive, and people are still sending it out to this day. If you go into Trump's statement about the events of Charlottesville in 2017, it really is him excusing the white nationalists and refusing to recognize and sort of inventing this idea that, well, maybe they were just people concerned about statues. But he was, if you look at the specific group of people he's referring to with that very fine people comment, it was the guys with the tiki torches. It was the white nationalists. So that's the problem, is if a guy whose main thing is he fights and he's angry, he can pick the wrong fights and he can pick a fight that helps to discredit yourself.
But how can you assume that he was talking about the tiki torch bearers and not just people protesting against
Look up Trzezinski Charlottesville hoax. Go on Google. You'll find my article. I go through it detail by detail, line by line, to exactly what he said. I'm not assuming it. I'm taking it from his words. Very detailed analysis. Because he actually refers to the people the night before. And the night before was Saturday night, the night before the big riot. It's specifically the Tiki Torch March.
Well, so Trump has a lot of precedence when it comes to, you know, jumping all over the place and speaking things now and then later. So I think it's a little bit of a stretch to say that he was talking about the night before.
No, read my article. It is not a stretch. I demonstrate it line by line. I'd nail him down.
You know what? Honestly, what it looks like to me is just a media hit job in order to demonize Trump and tie him to certain groups.
Read my article. I wrote like 2,000 words covering.
I mean, you're a classical liberal. I mean, you have an agenda, so why should I trust you?
Well, here, Doc, I'll make you. Why don't you read it and I'll read it, and Rob will be back with us on Tuesday. And we can take another crack at this because we are just about running out of time. But I really enjoyed this extremely lively discussion. We're all going to know a lot more in the next 24 hours. And I want to also encourage you guys to join us tomorrow. I'm going to be on our weekly webinar interviewing Professor Gad Saad. He's got a new book out called The Parasitic Mind. And to Jacques and Damien and others, you can find it on our Atlas Society website under the events section. I thought in particular he had an interesting analysis from sort of a consumer behavioralist perspective on the Trump phenomenon, but you know, specifically on what he saw as what he called kind of a psychogenic hysteria in terms of the people in his academic circle and social circle when it came to Trump. So let's take, you know, let's convene tomorrow for that, take a look at that. He also has had a lot of very interesting conversations with Joe Rogan on his show. And then right after that, I am going to be having another Clubhouse at 3:30 tomorrow with Stephen Hicks, our senior scholar, on the topic of is capitalism imperialistic and warlike? So that should be interesting. And then after that, guys, we're going to have the reception kicking off our gala week here in Malibu at Rafi Lounge. That's going to be, that reception is tomorrow night. That's Wednesday night. And then, of course, Thursday night is our fifth annual gala honoring Peter Thiel with Palmer Luckey speaking as well. I know I see a lot of faces of people who are going to be there, but if you can't be there, you may want to consider picking up a virtual ticket and joining us that way. So thank you very much, Rob. Thanks, David. Thank you. Richard Salzman just joined us. Thanks, Damien, Chris, Scott, Kirk, everybody else. Vanessa, Chris is the one of the main organizers behind all of those Spanish language memes and Spanish language interviews and Instagram takeovers that you see. And of course, others in this audience who will remain anonymous are some of the people that are making that possible through their generosity. So thanks, everyone, and hope to see you guys tomorrow.